heart beats faster and faster.
Good evening. That's right. This is the Ghost Band and Demon Hunter show. Let's see if I can do something like my buddy Sean Burris would do. Let's see here. Find something I could say that sounds almost as thoughtful as him. A revelation has been missed, an epiphany forgotten. Something great is coming, but I do not know if it comes on a shaft of light or with the fangs and claws that hide in the corner of the night. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show, paranormal broadcasting, where I'm sad to say my better half is gone, but I'm happy to say he's been replaced with someone much, much prettier. We are joined tonight with Amber Rose Hammond, who is sitting in the second chair there for me tonight, and I appreciate it greatly. She's over at the what would be the Ghost Man studios tonight. Amber Rose and I will be watching the chat room all night long, and you can log into that chat room by going to our website at www.ghostanddemon.com. The Ghost Man Sean B is not with us tonight, but I am Nathan S, aka the Demon Hunter, and tonight is the Sunday, July. What's the date? It's the 25th. 25th. 25th episode of the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show. The Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show is independently produced by Nathan Schoonover and Sean Burris, and is broadcast live on Absurd Radio and Planet Paranormal Radio, and is recorded for Planet Paranormal Radio and the Black Vault Radio Network. Tonight's guest, known to many as James Axler, it is Mark Ellis, who is going to be bringing us not only tales of his newest book, Cryptozoica, but the ideas behind hidden archaeological influences that have been kind of overlooked or, shall we say, tucked away so that the average American Joe just can't get a hold of it, and how it led him to write the book about dinosaurs among us, said to be the dino book of the decade. So if you'll stick around, I am sure that the lovely Amber Rose and I will be able to bring you a very interesting show tonight. We're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to all of you being here. And that's because the Ghost Man Demon Hunter show is beyond the normal broadcast, and it's going to start right now. Now, Bob, I told you the Ghost Man wasn't here tonight. He was supposed to introduce you, Amber. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Oh, wait, let's see here. We're going straight into commercials here. Let me stop that there. Sorry. Anyway, Amber Rose.
Nathan.
How are you?
I'm actually sort of depressed today.
You're depressed?
I'm actually depressed. I didn't say it earlier, but I have, for the first time, my poor baby, which is my cat, is sick. I know you're a cat lover, so I'm like, Nathan will understand.
I do.
But, yeah, so I'm kind of like in that kind of semi-paranoid, especially with it happening on a Sunday, because, you know, heaven forbid a veterinarian's office be open on a Sunday. And so you kind of do that paranoid thing, because they can't talk to you and say, hey, I'm sick and this is where it hurts. you kind of just look at the poor thing going, what can I do? And it's kind of unnerving, you know. It's frustrating. So I'm actually kind of anxious, and well, I'm looking forward to waking up at 7 in the morning, which it normally is unheard of. And can't wait to get to the vet's office to drop her off and say, fix her.
Well, you know, that's a dangerous thing to say when you drop a cat off at a vet's office.
Well, okay, I shouldn't use the word fix her. She's already been fixed, but you know, do something, make her better again, you know?
You know, you know I'm a cat lover. I've had several cats. The last two cats I had went through bad patches at the end, but they always managed to plot against me and get sick on Sundays.
Yeah, see? It's a global cat conspiracy then.
It is. And I think they've put it together with the veterinarians.
Yeah. They're working together. They're in cahoots, so you have to go pay. You know, there was some emergency thing I could call that's like an hour away, and I'm like, you know, it's awful because if it was a human, you'd be like, oh, my God, we're going. We don't care how far, how, you know, what's the distance? We're going. But with a cat, unfortunately, you're kind of like, well, maybe they can just stick it out, you know, I don't know. And
well, cats get sick all the time, don't they? And they'll get better, and we'll just keep an eye on them.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Hopefully nothing serious.
And yet, Amber Rose, you were kind enough to join us here tonight.
I was. They'll take my mind off things.
Okay, that's good. Well, you know, it was funny. For all those of you who are our regular Ghostman and Demon Hunter fans, Sean Burris unfortunately got called away to work tonight. He could not do the show. He was very disappointed. He texted me and was like, not going to be there, you know, and I was like, oh, man. Well, Mark Ellis is on tonight, who is also known as James Axler. I was not going to cancel this show because I really wanted to get him on the show. Anyone who is an Outlanders fan or a comics fan or, you know, any of those markets knows James Axler, and I really wanted to have him on the show, and I just couldn't pass it up. And so I started calling around, and Amber said, yeah, I'll do it. And I kind of jumped up and down a little bit and quietly so she wouldn't hear. And I went and got my cigar down at Butthead's Tobacco Emporium. I've got Butthead's. I've got my own Camacho cigar ready to smoke for the night. And you might be able to hear the, what are they called, cicadas? Amber?
Yeah, they're cicadas.
Cicada bugs out in the distance because the studio, in order for me to smoke in the studio, I have to keep the window open. So during the winter, you can hear the plow trucks go by. And during the summer, you can hear the cicada bugs, so... But I thought we had cicadas last year. Don't they only come out like once every 7 years?
I thought that, you know, and I stepped out the door and I heard, and now I'm not hearing them anymore. So I don't know.
I'm wondering if mine are just crickets. Maybe I just have crickets.
Yeah, maybe it was crickets or
the
something.
The peeper frogs, they're in cahoots too, it seems. They're all in cahoots against us. The cicada bugs and the peeper frogs. They're all out to get us. And it's bizarre because, you know, the last time, Amber, you and I hung out was where?
I think it would have been Keith Age's Louisville Mid-South Paranormal Conference.
Oh, gosh. That was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And as I recall, you did not have your knee socks at the time.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. For all you people listening out there, Nathan Schoonover has this wild idea that I wear, knee-high socks? That he's seen me in these knee-high socks, soccer shorts, and what else? I don't know. I think we came up with a squirt t-shirt or something.
You came up with a squirt t-shirt.
He's just convinced that he has seen me in this getup. And it's never happened.
I swear
but Nathan has this great fantasy about this.
I swear to God, the first time I ever met Amber Rose, she was coming down running over Devil's Den in Gettysburg, coming running down the hill, and I swear she had on like soccer shorts and knee-high socks, and I thought, who brought their daughter with them? And
Nathan, you're part of the 12 and under club too.
I'm getting gray. Working with Sean Burris every week is turning me gray. So I don't. Although I did see the pictures of you at the wedding.
Oh yeah, that was I had to actually, if anyone knows me, I'm not fond of dowling up. I'm a jeans and t-shirt type person, and my boyfriend's wedding, not his wedding, his sister's wedding, I was required to dress up. And so I had to end up going down to a hair salon and sitting there for 2 hours getting my hair and makeup done. And needless to say, people didn't even recognize me. And even though it's a compliment in a bizarre way, I kept hearing, well, you clean up well. thanks. What does that mean? Thanks. I know it's a compliment in a weird way, but thanks.
Well, you know, you were absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning. You were all dolled up, and it made me think of an article I was reading from Newsweek last week, and that's why I brought it up. Apparently, there's a dating website called beautifulpeople.com. Have you heard about this?
No.
They supposedly limit their reach only to the most attractive people. But they're claiming to have over 600,000 members worldwide.
Oh my God, good luck with that.
So they're the most attractive 600,000 people in the world, apparently. So they've recently announced a sponsor to combine an egg and sperm bank for its members.
Oh my God.
To sell their essence for a fee.
Okay, this is reminiscent of Hitler.
It actually kind of reminded me of, what was that movie a few years back where you could genetically code your children to get the most beautiful children? But they want, however, the manager, Greg Huge, I believe his name is, told Newsweek in June that homely customers will be welcome to purchase these eggs and sperm, where they only host to the most beautiful people. They will still be offering the eggs to the non-beautiful people because everybody, including ugly people, would like to bring a good-looking child into the world, and they just can't be selfish.
So, and this is a real website. Like, they're honestly trying to make money off this.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. And it was in Newsweek magazine on the 21st of last month. And I couldn't help but think about that when I was like, I need a beautiful person and I article. And it came up and I was like, oh, this is perfect for the G&D show.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was, we're both going through the same mic right now. I hope that works okay. But it was just one of those crazy things that came up. And I didn't know what I was going to talk about tonight, and that came up, and I was just like, how do you judge who gets to give away beautiful sperm? How do you judge
it's perception. I mean, we all know, even in the paranormal, everything's about perception. And, I mean, what's beautiful to one person is hideous to another. I mean, that's just, I mean, I know they said that there's certain geometric features on a face that 99 people out of 100 agree are beautiful attributes to have, but you know, there's just I'm not attracted to the normally, you know, you see some hunky guy or some Brad Pitt guy walk by, I'm not gonna look twice at him. Like, so I mean, everyone's different, and that's just, I can't, I'm gonna have to look that website up. That's evil.
It's beautifulpeople.com. So
beautifulpeople.com. I'll have to look that up.
I wanted to get out onto this too. You wrote a book.
I did.
Since the last time I saw you, you have published a book.
Yes. It's Ghosts and Legends of Michigan's West Coast, because while Nathan's sitting over in beautiful Connecticut, I'm sitting over on lovely Lake Michigan, and I'm a big local history fan. And so I wrote a book that's kind of a combination of hauntings and histories about our side of the state and all of its fun legends and quirky stories and haunted lighthouses and ghost ships and all that fun stuff. So if you're a fan of Michigan, or if you're listening to Michigan, it's definitely, I hope, worth a read. I haven't had one negative comment, which is definitely a perk on any new author's side. So
now,
I'm proud of it.
To be fair to the rest of us who say we're going to write a book,
yes,
you have an unfair advantage. Because you actually know how to use a library to look things up.
I happen to work in a library, so it is and that was a huge asset, especially when you write about local history. Our particular library, I live in Grand Haven, Michigan, has a absolutely stunning local history department, and a lot of libraries don't have that. And
if they do, most of us don't know where to find it. So it's
But it's just, it's a valuable, I mean, libraries, people are forgetting that libraries, what a valuable resource libraries are, because a lot of states, I don't know if Connecticut has had this problem, but with the recent, downturn in the economy, a lot of libraries are losing their public funding, and they're hurting. But the ironic thing is more and more people are using libraries because they can't afford internet, they can't afford to go out and buy books, and so they're coming to use all the free resources that libraries have, and yet the state's, you know, tugging our money away. And so it's now's the time to go support your public library. You know, you don't have a library card, go pick one up. It's, you know, they're awesome places, especially some of them are like the most beautiful forms of architecture in a community. I mean, we just got a new one built, and it's just, it's amazing. People walk in and their jaws drop, and they're just wonderful. So,
and
I do have that lucky advantage that it's very easy to snag research and grab things. And
do yourself, do the library a favor, go in, use your library card, take out a book, keep it a few extra days so you have to pay for it when you come back so they can earn some money.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's how they make the money, folks. It's
Exactly. And I always tell people, because we get people, you know, you get those real winners that, what? I have a 30-cent fine? No. And they're freaking out on you. And I'm looking at them like, are you kidding? This isn't a Blockbuster fee. This isn't an overdraft fee for a bank. This is a 30-cent fine that's going in to purchase more children's books, more resources for your community and for yourself, you know, and you're whining about your 30-cent fine because you were late bringing your book back.
Well, you know what's funny about that, too, is I think the worst fine I've ever had, not including when I was a kid, because once when I was a kid, I actually ruined a book. And my family was so poor that I couldn't afford to pay for the book, so I had to work it off.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like washing dishes when you couldn't afford your dinner kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the worst fine I've had as an adult, I think, was like $2. And I walked in and I paid the $2, and I was just like, well, it's still a bargain. I got to read the book for $2. It's I couldn't have gotten that on Kindle.
The book is $26.
Yeah.
you got your, you know, Dan Brown comes out with his newest, latest, and greatest, and you're going to pay $26 unless you go over to Barnes & Noble and get 40% off, which I also don't advocate because I also support your local bookstore. And so it's. Yeah, I mean, and you don't have the money, you go grab it from the library.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually have to go and pick up my books at the library whenever I want to read a new Dean Koontz book.
Yep.
Because I swore I would not buy another Dean Koontz book until he came out with the third book in the Christopher Snow series.
Is that the Odd Thomas?
No, Odd Thomas, I've actually read all, those are the ones I've been reading at the library, the Odd Thomas books.
Okay.
But, he had a series before that called the Fear Nothing and Seize the Night. They were called, and they were called the Christopher Snow series. And it's about a young man in his late 20s, early 30s, who is allergic to sunlight and has a very unusual nighttime life. So obviously I was very connected to this book.
Yeah.
at the time I was in my early 30s and allergic to sunlight, and so I he has XP in the book, which I don't have. I have polymorphic light eruption, but you know, it's a total, his is fatal, mine is annoying, but
yeah.
It was still a connection to the book, and it stopped at like this huge cliffhanger, and he hasn't come out with any books since on that particular series. So I've sworn not to buy another Dean Koontz book until He finishes the series.
One.
This does not mean I won't go to the library and read the books, but it's definitely one of those things I want to see come out. Now, you, last time we were together, we were talking about the fact that you had seen a UFO.
Oh my God, yes.
And have you been asked a lot of questions about that UFO?
You know, I mean, I run a Michigan paranormal website called Michigan's Other Side. And we still get the most number one thing we get is, you know, ghost-related stuff. But when someone asks me, because the number one question, which you've probably had this, you know this, when you are a ghost hunter or you investigate this stuff, the biggest question you ask is, well, what's the scariest thing you've ever seen? And I tell people, well, okay, I've seen a couple bizarre things that, you know, scared the crap out of me, but number one was a UFO. And they look at me like, what? What? And UFOs are more real to me. Ghosts are subjective. Like we said, we mentioned earlier, perception. UFOs creep me out, partly because probably what Hollywood's done to us and thinking, you know, Independence Day and you know, War of the Worlds and all this stuff. But you can't explain it. I mean, you see, that's something that you're seeing physical in the sky, not like an apparition goes darting through the wall and stuff. This is something unexplainable in the sky. And there's nothing you can do but sit there and gaze at it and wonder what, you know, what next. And so that was definitely probably one of the most chilling things I've seen.
Now, after that, your partner in Michigan Other Siders It is Other Siders, right? Because I know I
other,
always
no, just Other Side.
Other Side. I always say it wrong. I have not said it once.
That's okay.
It's like Scott L. trying to say my name. It just doesn't happen.
That's okay.
Doesn't happen. That's why I became Nathan Unpronounceable on Ghostly Talk.
Yes.
But Tom Mott, your partner in Michigan Other Side, actually joined MUFON after that experience.
He did. He's still like a member of MUFON, but he did the whole investigation thing, and he even got disgusted with MUFON. Because when you go to join, he was really excited. Like, okay, I'm going to be part of MUFON now. This is going to be such a welcome, refreshing change from the hectic, crazy world of the paranormal that's just become so convoluted and media frenzy and just, you know, all the stuff that's gone on in the paranormal of lately and the drama. He's like, this is going to be a clean slate. This is going to be great. You know, MUFON is extremely organized and everything. And he found out there was just as much inside drama within the UFO world as in the paranormal. So he's not a complete active investigator anymore, but he's still a member. But he did. Me, Tom and Scott, you know, it was a November night, and we're looking up in the sky, and Tom wanted a cigar, and I wanted to smoke. So we stepped out on the deck, and I kind of look up in the sky, and I'm watching a little light. And, you know, your first glance as a human is like, well, light in the sky, it's an airplane. Well, then when the sudden light took a sharp turn and darted back and took another sharp turn and darted back and had bizarre lights on it, you're kind of wondering, what am I looking at now? And so I told Tom, I said, what is that? And he looked, and he's like, that's not an airplane. And we sat there stunned, looking up, mouth open, drooling. And we got Scott. Scott was on the couch watching Police Academy. And we dragged him off the couch and said, okay, what is this? And, you know, he freaked out as well. There's a little video on our website of us. You can't see anything. Because after this happened, we need to take pictures, and I have a new appreciation for the blurry UFO photo. You know, these photos all over the internet, you know, oh my God, here's the UFO I saw, and it's a blurry light. Well, that's all you can capture. You can't get anything. You know, it's nighttime, and you've got this little speck in the sky darting around. You're not going to get anything. So there's a video of us, and you can actually hear how startled we are in our voices. And it disappeared, just poof. And Tom, that's when Tom ran and got his camera and his, of course, tripod isn't there when you need it.
Of course not.
And every ghost hunter knows your equipment isn't there when stuff happens. And we looked up in the sky, and it came back and darted around again. And then we went off in pursuit of it, which I tried to stay at home, and they said, no, you're coming with us. And we never saw it again.
I had a similar experience when I was in my mid-20s. I stopped with a friend of mine in a car. And we were looking at the Big Dipper, and we were both trying to figure out what these two extra stars were that were in the Big Dipper. And we had a whole conversation about them before they shot off in different directions, zigzagged around each other, and then shot across the night sky faster than either of us could really watch.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's an unidentified flying object. Excuse me, unidentified flying object. It's a UFO. Is it aliens?
Yeah.
Don't know, but it's definitely unidentified. Nobody.
Exactly.
It had been seen by several people. Nobody knew what it was. But, you know, they just had this UFO sighting in China. Have you heard about this
one? Yes, I did. I posted that on our forums, but then I didn't follow up. But there was a follow-up story, solving it?
Was it solved? Because the last thing I got on about it was that it had actually closed down an airport.
That's what I had read, that they had closed down an airport because of this, this light in the sky or whatever it was. And then when I was browsing Yahoo, quickly, I had seen something about China's UFO Explained, and now I remember I saw that, but I didn't go back and read it. So it's there, whatever they say it was, or if it was a hoax or whatever. But there is a follow up story with it.
I have to say, I have been watching this new Fact or Faked show on Sci-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and which, you know, is great. It's a great show because they go out and they take all these YouTube videos and see if they can recreate them. I'm hoping they won't do that to their own television shows because God knows what they'll find out. But, you know, it's a good show because they actually go out and they break all these videos down to try and find out if they're fact or faked. And if they can't figure it out, they're the first one to say. But when I saw this article on the UFO in China, I was surprised that this didn't make bigger news.
Yeah, I only saw it on Yahoo, and I don't know if it was mentioned on one of the networks or not, but we have UFO sightings all the time. I mean, Lake Michigan is a hotbed for that kind of stuff, and You know, who knows? If you think about it, when you look over, you know, the planet, Michigan stands out, no pun intended, like a sore thumb. And it, you know, I don't know, if you're cruising around in, like, your UFO and you're like, hey, that state looks, you know, interesting. Let's go check that out. I don't know, but we have tons of them, and we have so many spotties, and there's been kind of a little flap lately again, so, I don't know.
I'd like to find somebody who could, like, put different things together and find out, like, if more UFOs are sighted when there's more volcanoes going off. Because maybe the Scientologists have it right. We just don't know. It's,
maybe they do.
But, last thing on the news, I had a couple stories here. Sean and I were talking, like, last week, or the week before last, about the Bigfoot spotted in North Carolina.
Oh, I didn't see that
mountains.
One.
Yeah, and apparently there's this huge investigation going on now because Bigfoot's been spotted again in North Carolina. So I was looking up, like, crypto reports, trying to find crypto reports on it. Couldn't find a whole lot on it. What I wound up finding was a totally opposite story. You know, we often hear these things about, like, crypto reports. People cite these things. They turn out to be something else, whatever. Apparently in Frankfort, Kentucky... I think it's Kentucky. Kentucky's KY, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
An American Kennel Club registered dog was turned loose after wildlife in the wild after the Frankfurt Humane Society mistook it for a coyote. It was a Shiba Inu, or however you say these. It was a copper-colored dog. And the Humane Society actually went into this woman, Lori Goodlett's yard, took her 11-year-old, a.k.a. breed dog, and then released it into the wild because they believed it was a coyote.
Wow.
The Humane Society board chairman, John Forbes, said that he backs the shelter for their decision. But at the same time, they've now taken this poor dog and just nabbed it up and released it. They didn't. The woman came home and her dog was gone. And,
ridiculous.
You know, you and I are pet lovers. We know how this is. Yeah. I mean, this is total reversed kind of thing. This is somebody actually coming to your yard, taking your possession.
Yeah, just assuming, oh my God, it's a coyote.
Yeah. And fortunately, the officers had the foresight to photograph the dog. But so far, no one has heard from this copper little pooch. And the Goodletts are asking anybody in the area to keep an eye out for their puppy.
Aw.
But that's about it for the news. Amber, would you like to take a quick break? I'll play some music, and when we come back, we'll have our guest, Mark Ellis.
Sounds good.
Everybody, Amber Rose. Name of your book again, Amber, and where people can find it.
Oh, you can find it. You can find it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon. All the main booksellers sell it. You can find it at michiganotherside.com. We sell it for a little cheaper than the bookstores, but you can find it anywhere.
All righty. And we'll be right back after this. We're going to have a quick break with some music by Anxiety of Influence with their song Insomnic. So, and we'll be right back after that.
FandomCon 2010, August 12th through the 15th in Hickory, North Carolina. Come meet your favorite celebrities in the horror and paranormal community. Horror guests include Vanessa Demon Rosa, Alex Vincent, the face of Michael Myers, Tony Moran. Paranormal guests include John Zaffis, Stephen and Elliot Lachance, Bishop James Long, plus many, many more. 1, 2, 3, and 4-day passes offered, with 4-day passes only available in advance. This is the 4-day paranormal and horror event you've been waiting for. For more information, go to PhantomCon.com. PhantomCon 2010 in Hickory, North Carolina, August 12th. Through the 15th, www.phantomcon.com.
podcasts? Well, come and visit us at planetparanormal.com. We are your guide to the other side. Come and check out our hub to see all our latest podcasts from your favorite paranormal celebrities. And don't forget to check out our news feeds to see what's late great in the paranormal community, as well as events coming to a town near you. Come visit us on the web at www.planetparanormal.com. That's www.planetparanormal.com.
Hey, this is Nathan S. of the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show. When we needed a logo that would tell people what we were all about but was different from anything else out there, we went right to Loki Graphics at LokiGraphicsInc.com. We love the artwork that owner and illustrator Jonathan Sullivan came up with so much, we ordered our t-shirts and banners from Loki Graphics right away. They provided us with high-quality graphic art, screen printing, and helped us pick out the best value for our t-shirts and other products that fit our budget. LokiGraphicsInc.com is the official graphic designer and screen printer for the Ghostman and Demon Hunter show. Phone, email, and postal orders are all accepted, with contact information available on their website. Shipping is available for any order, or if you're local, you can stop by the shop and pick up your finished product. Check out Loki Graphics at LokiGraphicsInc.com and tell them the Ghostman and Demon Hunter sent you.
Hi, this is Shannon Sylvia from Ghost Hunters International, and you're listening to Ghost Man and the Demon Hunter Show.
All you heathens and hooligans, come on and get the hell out of here.
Oy vey. Hey, we're back at the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show. La 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 la. And I am hoping I have my dear Amber Rose online with me
here,
right now.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
There were some crazy things happened during those commercials there. But I'm glad we got you back, Amber.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. And in the third chair, sitting over there on the other side of the country, up in Rhode Island, is our... our buddy, our pal, our friend, glad to have him here tonight, Mark Ellis.
Hey, Nathan.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut off, but I'm doing good.
I thought that never worked.
No, being a farm boy, I can tell you, it happens.
Oh, I know.
The more fun is the turkeys with their head cut off, because they actually run around a lot longer.
I never saw that. I did see the chicken, but not the turkey.
I'm going to get calls from PETA against me now. You know that.
Well, you didn't do it, so. Or at least not on air.
I was eight, so they can't blame me that bad. Oh, so, Mark, you've never met my dear sweet Amber Rose.
No, I haven't had the pleasure.
Amber, this is Mark Ellis.
Hello.
So we actually asked Mark on tonight, Amber, because he's just come out with a new novel, Cryptozoica, which from what I've been told, it's being called the Dino Book of the Decade, Mark.
Yeah, it's the response has been surprisingly positive, and it's only been out such a short time, and I haven't even really done any real major promotion for it yet. You're the first.
We're the first, another Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show first. Sean Burris will wish he was here so he could have said that.
Oh, okay. But you have a bell. Ding.
Ding. Oh, he's got the bell. Yeah, darn it. All I have is the little comment thing for Sean.
The comments of Sean Burris do not represent those of Ghost Man and Demon Hunter or their affairs.
But he, oh, wait, no, that's wrong. Everything's going haywire tonight, Mark, but... But that's okay. It was a crazy night to begin with. But the premise behind the book, it's kind of when you and I first discussed it when you were working on it, it had that kind of lost world mentality to it.
Yeah, it's basically an updating of the lost world theme, more of a modern day thriller though. I mean, the lost world part of it is. Definitely, it's an iconic kind of concept. Since there are obviously lost worlds still in existence. I mean, people are still finding things in the Malaysian jungles and even in Tibet that not on the map and never been discovered as of yet, or at least if it was discovered, it was perhaps suppressed.
Now,
so that's one of the underlying themes of Cryptozoica.
What I want to know is how Google Earth hasn't managed to get a street view photo of any of this stuff for us.
Well, the thing about satellite imagery is you have to know what you're looking for. You know, for example...
I think if a T-Rex ran underneath my satellite, I'd know what I was looking at.
Well, if they didn't have it on a particular island, they'd never see it.
Okay.
That's how satellite imagery works. They may have a particular island on the image of it, but they're not going to, you know, waste a lot of time and trouble, you know, zooming in on any just random island just to see what's going on unless they have a reason.
Well,
I did do the research on that because I had to ask the same question. Well, why wouldn't satellite imagery show up something like this? And I found out that despite, you know, some of the press to the contrary, satellite imagery does not cover every square inch of the world. And the people who run the satellites, the companies or what have to have a specific request to zoom in on a specific longitude and latitude.
You know, because I often wondered that, having seen the movie Castaway, why nobody ever saw, you know, Tom Hanks wandering around on the island from a satellite. And
well, the thing is, there's particularly in some of the, you know, South China Sea, like Sulu Sea, where Cryptozoica takes place, there's probably about 1,000 islands out there that weren't even charted until World War II. And out of that 1,000, there's probably at least 500 that nobody's ever set foot on.
Really?
At least as far as anybody knows. That's one of the things that's established in Cryptozoica, is that even though there might be a name on a map, doesn't mean that anybody's ever explored it.
And where are these islands?
The South Sulu Seas, South China Seas.
So we're not going to...
Indochina, Malaysia...
If somebody, like, lands on these islands, they're not going to find, like, the children of World War II Japanese fighters who were hidden away there who think the war is still going on,
right? They very well could. One of the reasons piracy has taken such a, you know, resurgence, or actually in that particular part of the world it's never really left, is because there's so many islands out there that have never been charted. And it's very difficult to pinpoint where they're at. So, you know, and a lot of the pirates, they just move their base from one of these little crappy islands to another.
I see. Now, you were telling me earlier that a lot of what you came up with for this these stories, especially Cryptozoica, came from the idea that there has been hidden evidence of DNA and historical research and archaeological? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
Research.
Archaeological.
Thank you.
Well, there's always been the mystery of the mother culture. Graham Hancock and people like David Childress have touched on this in a number of their books about the mother culture that has influenced all these others, from, you know, the Egyptians to the Incas to the Mayas. There's a commonality, not only in legends, but also in simple things like architecture and imagery. And one of the recurring motifs, as far as imagery goes, is the serpent motif. And it seems unusual that that motif occurs in so many cultures all over the world, even in places where serpents aren't common.
Okay.
Like the United Kingdom and things like that. Same thing like with dragons, you know. It's another... recurring motif in cultures as far as myths and legends.
I thought like Ireland had snakes until St. Patrick chased them all off.
Yeah, how did that work? You know, that's just obviously that's just a mythological retelling of something like driving out the pagans and serpent worship. You know, even though I dealt with it in one of my Outlanders books a little bit.
Well, that's right. You're the author of the Outlander books as well, the James Axler Outlander books.
Yes, I created the Outlander series as James Axler back in, well, actually started working on it in 1995. And I've been writing it up until recently, since 1996. I also wrote a number of books in the Deathlands series as well, but the Outlander series I created. And
it was funny. I actually have to send you a photo of it because I was driving back from Whisper's estate 2 weeks ago, and I stopped at a rest stop, and there was literally a shrine to James Axler in the rest stop. And I took a picture of it. I got to send it to you. But pretty much every Outlanders book and Deathlands book that you ever worked on was in this huge case. And I just...
Well, it's in a, the audiobooks are very popular. A company does audiobook versions of the novels. They do them like old-time radio with multiple voice actors and music and sound effects. And they stock a lot of them in truck stops, and they're very popular with over-the-road truckers because, you know, they like to listen to them. You know, they're 8-9 hours long, so it's something they can focus on.
And it got me home. It got me home from Indianapolis. I got to say, though, folks, if you're going to go out and you're going to pick up one of these books, start at number one or zero if they have it, because you really got to know what's going on.
Recurring series. I guess there's like 50 in the out 51 or 52 in the Outlander series alone right now.
I remember I got two of them for Christmas a couple years ago from Chrissy P, and they were fabulous books, but it took me about a halfway through to figure out what was going on because I hadn't read the earlier ones on, and I'm like, oh, they're time traveling. I get it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, that was it. That, when I, since I wrote them for so many years, for like 15 years, I had to keep coming up with different plots, not just to keep me from, you know, keep my interest up. But when I was writing the Outlander series, because you're speaking of time travel, I introduced a concept in one of the books about an old time travel experiment from the 20th century that had been reactivated and was running wild and snatching people and animals from all epochs of history and depositing on this little island, dinosaurs included. And I had noticed over a period of time when I got my royalty statements that every book that featured this island, which I called Thunder Isle, always enjoyed a spike in sales, and also fan reaction was always really good. So I thought, well, you know, since I always have loved the Lost World theme, I thought, why don't I just write a book, you know, based using that, but updated as best I can with the latest in, you know, zoological and biological, archaeological discoveries. So that's basically how Cryptozoica came to be.
You hear that, Amber? Royalties.
I do, and I'm absorbing all this. And, of course, I work at a library, so I'm sitting here going, I wonder if we have his books. I'm going to make sure we order his books. I'm going to totally promote them at the library. But this kind of goes with a recent conversation I was having with my buddy the other night about this kind of, I was saying, you know, if I could go back in time, I want to go back in time to this kind of golden age of archaeology when all this stuff wasn't explored yet. You could kind of go in and plunder and pillage in the right way. And kind of, you know, explore the pyramids and all these things when they're new. And, I mean, we got on this idea that, you know, everything's been explored. What, you know, if someone's going into archaeology right now, what is left in this world? We feel like with the Internet that we're, you know, we've embraced every little corner and every little inch of this planet, and really we haven't. So this concept of these unexplored worlds and thinking about something as realistic and tangible as Google Earth and seeing these places that are untouched is a really kind of cool concept on our, you know, when we think about our crowded planet and that there's nothing left, you know.
Well, yeah, that is a common perception, but there's probably, you know, vast areas of the Earth that are still uninhabited, you know, at least as far as we know, simply because we can't get to them. Like I said about the satellite imagery, that sounds good, but unless you know the exact coordinates to zero in on, you're not going to really notice it. I guess it wasn't that long ago where they found through satellite imagery when they're trying to find out what had happened to Colonel Fawcett back in the 1920s when he went into the Amazon looking for the lost city of Z. They got the general area where he went, you know, got the longitude and latitude and fed it into a satellite, and they actually came up with what they think is a city. A lost Mayan city buried in, you know, the Amazonian jungles, which he was trying to get to, you know, 70 years ago.
If only he had waited.
He might have made it.
Yeah.
Never came back.
Of course, he'd be disappointed now because he wouldn't have his flying car. So it's, you know, I expected more flying cars by now. Who wouldn't?
And jetpacks.
Hoverboard.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. But I also want to mention that with Cryptozoic, it's a big book. You know, it's pretty, I kind of took the loose epic approach with it. But it's illustrated as well.
Good, I like pictures.
Yeah, this is what I want. I mean, I was thinking about when I was writing it. It's so much better. I used to read all the books when I was growing up in the 60s, the paperback editions of the Edgar Rice Burroughs books, and you had Frank Frazetta and Reed Crandall and Roy Crinkle doing these, you know, beautiful covers and black and white illustrations on the interior of the books, and, you know, really, you know, stimulated the imagination. So I wanted to keep with that tradition as well, even though this is more of a updating of the Lost World kind of theme. I wanted to sort of echo that. So an artist, illustrator Jeff Slimmons, he provided 18 interior black and white illustrations as well as the beautiful full color wraparound cover. And he was so enthusiastic about it. I mean, he's a very well-known illustrator, and when he read some of Cryptozoic, he said, "Oh man, dude, this just has to be illustrated. You got to let me do it." So that's sort of how that came about.
Now, it's you know, I want to see a whole Cryptozoica series come out, but I'd like to see it like in the Choose Your Own Adventure style, where I could turn to page 27 if you want to go into the scary dark cavern, and.
Turn to page 19 if you want to face a triad assassin or
there
something.
There you go. Yeah.
I threw a lot of stuff in the book. I mean, from Asian triads and secret societies, and you know.
Now you did a lot of research on secret societies.
Yeah, I did. They're actually the Cryptozoic. I know it's become kind of a tiresome plot thing now. Partly due to Dan Brown and his, you know, his books. But I was dealing with secret societies and Outlanders, you know, long before Da Vinci Code, but that's neither here nor there. But anyway, there actually was one created in the 1500s by Sir Walter Raleigh called the School of Night. And it was formed during the reign of Elizabeth. And it was a group of, you know, scholars, and they met in secret at nighttime. So, you know, nobody could find out what they were talking about, you know. And really all they did was, like, sort of discuss the scientific findings of the day and that sort of thing. But one of the interesting things was a seer named John Dee, who was like Queen Elizabeth's astrologer as well as her sort of like secret agent. He had created, or supposedly, he claimed he didn't create it, but he would pass on secret messages in a language called Enochian from Enoch, from the Lost Books of Enoch, one of the apocryphal books of the Bible. And he claimed it was an angelic script, or basically, you know, it predated the human tongue, and it was called Enochian because Enoch was supposedly the last of the biblical patriarchs who could speak it.
Okay.
So that's part of the subtext of the book, too, that they're trying to decode the Enochian language.
Well, it's funny because when we actually did Extreme Paranormal, when we were out doing the summoning circle out on the lake, having been a member of certain secret societies myself in the past, I wouldn't let them actually film me doing the Enochian portion of the ritual. But that's what we used was Kelly's necro circle and the Enochian keys.
Right. So that's sort of what I did with in Cryptozoica. I mean, in my book Cryptozoica, I suggest that Enoch actually, this language actually was spoken. It's a written version of a spoken language from a non-human race that pre-existed humanity. And that's how it was handed down for, thousands of years. So that's the mother culture, basically. And finally sort of reached Charles Darwin's ears as well, so.
So there's some Darwinian in here, too.
Yeah, it's basically this. A lot of this whole thing, Darwin is the key to this. A lot of this information was hidden in his suppressed log. Darwin had in real life, Darwin had his A journal and his secret B journal. In my Cryptozoica, I suggest he had a double secret C journal as well. So that nobody saw, that the School of Night claimed and had hidden for, a couple of hundred years. So essentially, all these secrets come out, and a couple of guys come to the island 2 or 3 years before the book starts and inadvertently kick into motion the whole chain of events.
Now, there's always this idea that people find a secret, they go check it out, blah, blah, blah. Why doesn't anybody, when the dinosaurs start to show up, just leave?
Well, in this instance, in Cryptozoica, these two guys, Tombstone Jack Cavanaugh and his partner Augustus Crow, they were working for relief organizations right after the tsunami of a few years ago that really devastated Indonesia and that part of the world. And when they came across the island and glimpsed one of the life forms there, they came back and went, hey, we could maybe make some money off this thing. So that's what they decide they try to do,
So he's like the John Hammond of the Cryptozoica world.
Well, a little bit different than that. More like, sort of a P.T. Barnum in a way. It's basically when they're not stupid people, but they got some soil samples and things like that from the whole place, water samples, and had them analyzed and found out that the water and the soil was rich in antiviral compounds, just like. Like the rainforests of the Amazon, which has become a multi-billion-dollar cottage industry of all these pharmaceutical companies, scrambling to see if they can get the next miracle drug out of a tree or a flower or something like that. So they find that, and they take it to a Donald Trump type of person that they know, actually who they sort of, work for occasionally, more of a crony. And they concoct this idea that they can turn this whole area. It's a two island chain. They can make this into like a super elite health spa for the ultra rich, as well as like a big scientific research kind of a thing. And it's sort of like a Jurassic Park thing, but not like a amusement park. But more of an observatory for universities and things, and they want, grants and things like that. But because of where they're operating in that part of the world, they have to get permission from the triads, United Bamboo.
Right.
And then that gets really messy. So the whole thing just falls apart 2 years before the book really starts,
Now, will they have libraries? Because Amber's going to be looking for a job.
Yeah. So anyway, despite the fact that it seems like, you know, I really have done a lot of research on it. I sort of went back to an earlier tradition of writing thrillers, which was like, you know, tough guys, you know, doing drinking and swearing and fist fighting and things like that. And there's humor in it and things like that. It's not exactly what's been accepted as the standard thriller nowadays, where it's always a race against time with somebody with a bomb or a virus.
I was going to say, you mean the president's not going to get blown up and you have 24 hours to save him?
Well, they got a few hours to get out of this island before something bad happens. They end up on it crashed, you know, and they're trapped there. But it's like I said, it's got a lot of different things going on in it. I tried to cover all sorts of bases and all sorts of different action sequences, and very cinematic, which was intentional. You know, everything I learned while I wrote Outlanders for all those years is in Cryptozoica, but it's a little bit more refined, a little bit more streamlined. I'm writing for a slightly different, basically the same audience, but the genre is a little bit different. In Outlanders, I had to, like, okay, I've had 5 pages, now time for a gunfight. Another 5 pages, okay, I got to have a fist fight, that sort of thing.
You were talking about the research that goes into it. You had to actually research into cryptozoology, you had to study dinosaurs, you had to study, like you were talking about, the antivirals in the soil.
Oh yeah, I had to research microbiology, I had to research paleontology, zoology, and geography, you know. When I first came up with the idea, I had to come up with an area that seemed the most likely where this could happen. And then that suggested all sorts of other things, like the triad involvement and such. But yeah, I had to do an enormous amount of research because I wanted this to be very believable. You know, the old thing that worked in the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World, you know, 90 years ago, about different types of, you know, dinosaurs on a plateau in South America isn't going to work nowadays, because he mixed Jurassic dinosaurs, Cretaceous dinosaurs, things like that. And I also, as much as I actually enjoyed the Jurassic Park concept, that whole thing about cloning dinosaurs, the chain of coincidence that would have allowed that to happen, as it was presented, like in the first book and movies and stuff, would have just been so astronomical. It was really unbelievable, you know. I mean, I could maybe agree that you could find sufficient DNA sample to maybe bioengineer one dinosaur or one species of dinosaur, but not all of those.
Well, it's interesting that you go into that, because when we deal with the bioengineering aspect of it, the science is so intense that they can pretty much tell us laymen that are just listening to the story anything and will believe it. Much like you were saying earlier with the Dan Brown, he can say just about anything about a secret society and people will believe it because they don't know what really goes on.
Exactly. I mean, you have to buy into it and accept it. Okay, they're relying on the ignorance, I guess, of a certain area of science. And they say genetic engineering, and it seems so complicated, which it is, obviously, but that's the whole problem. Because it is so complicated, there's almost no way that you would be able to find an intact DNA sample that you could clone a dinosaur. And in the book and the movie, first movie, they said they supplied the links in the chain with frog DNA, you know? I would have hated to see the results of the trial and error on that.
Well, you know, it's funny, too, because I've seen reports on genetic splicing and things like that. And if you were to... We're, what, 3 points away from that of a chimpanzee?
Right.
And if you took those 3 points out and replaced them with human DNA, you'd just come up with a really messed up chimpanzee.
That's exactly it.
It would either be like literally brain dead and malformed, or just be born dead.
Yeah, it's not going to look like Cornelius.
Right.
You know, it's not going to be that way at all. So yeah, so I had to, when I wanted to come up with a reasonable seeming explanation for how the dinosaurs could have survived, I had to do a lot. And I think, you know, and I ran it past scientists of my acquaintance, and they, you know, biologists, and they said, yeah, I mean, you know, it's extreme possibility, but it is possible. And I stuck strictly with dinosaurs from the Cretaceous era, right before the KT extinction event.
Okay.
You know, so I didn't have them spread all over, you know, it was strictly towards animals that were alive during the end of the Cretaceous period, which was right before the extinction event. So, you know, and I realized what I was doing in the sense that if this was an island, there's got to be an explanation why all the herbivores didn't strip it of vegetation and all the carnivores just eat them all up inside the first couple of years. So I sort of came up with an explanation for that as well.
Okay. Now, you and I have actually sat around in your living room, which has been a fabulous thing for me to be able to sit with you and talk. We've gotten to sit around and discuss things, and we actually sat there one night and had a ghost show on TV.
Right.
And you and I have sat around discussing the possibilities and probabilities of what people do to find ghosts. And since we talked a lot about Arthur Conan Doyle earlier and stuff like that, and he was such a strong spiritualist, and he wanted to believe, you know, how much of that, like, do you look into of what people want to believe and fit that into your books?
Very much. I mean, people want to believe that there's quite, like the cryptids, you know, the cryptozoologists. I mean, that's one of the underpinnings of cryptozoology, the survivors of prehistoric survivors. You know, there are reports constantly of some sorts of dinosaur animals, like the Molo Makimbe, which is apparently a sauropod in Africa. I believe Joss Gates has more than once went to look for these types of, you know, prehistoric survivors on Destination Truth, like the Roken in New Zealand, which is supposedly a giant. Or is that New Guinea? New Guinea.
New Guinea.
Yeah, which is supposedly like a pterodactyl or something like that. So people want to believe that it's possible. You know, and I mean, there's really no more an iconic type of image than a modern human running in terror from like a, you know, from like a T-Rex.
But, you know,
I mean, people just love that, and so do I. So, but the thing is to try to make it seem like it's possible, you know, and then part of the reasons is people are willing to, who are into this, like the pulp style adventures, they're willing to suspend their disbelief a little bit.
And, you know, it's funny because I know when I was a kid, I would dream of dinosaurs. So as children, we see these things that seem so unbelievable and we're told they're true. We dream of seeing them again.
Yes, I know.
I remember a few years back, didn't they find like a full body of a T-Rex that was still had blood in the veins?
Yeah, the caked blood. But yes, they did, as a matter of fact. It was almost an intact fossil. Well, most of it was fossilized, but they actually found parts of a hide still, you know, tissue, actual
right.
tissue, that hadn't become completely fossilized. But, I mean, they find things still all the time. I mean, what was it? Just a couple of months ago, they found a species of monitor lizard, giant monitor lizard in the Philippines, which had been reported for a couple of hundred years, but scientists dismissed as a legend. It was a golden lizard. It was gold-colored.
Oh.
And they didn't believe it existed until somebody brought it down out of the hills in just the past, you know, like, I think it was in May.
I thought you were going to tell me it was like one of those 40-foot monitors that I hear.
No, not one of them. I wish it was, but no, but it was a water monitor lizard, but it was golden, and it had never been, you know, it had never been really cataloged. It had just been reported. So, you know, there's no telling. I mean, I wish, I'm not even going to say that there's not going to be some sort of like discovery made of something like this. Who really knows?
Well, you know, it's funny because there are people who spend their lives looking for this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's, of course, there's the coelacanth, which everybody's heard about. You know, they just caught a coelacanth and this fish that was supposed to be extinct, they pulled it out of the water and they said, oh, look, it still exists.
Yeah, and it's supposed to have been extinct for 90 million years.
And everybody gained hope again. But when you look back at, like, the great apes, the graybacks, I guess they're the great apes, silverbacks,
yep.
they were just legends until the 1950s.
Oh, I know, the mountain gorillas, yeah.
Yep.
They didn't think they existed. I guess the bonobo chimps, they thought that they were not real either up until, like, the early 1900s.
Now, those are the chimps that have sex on, like, for everything, right?
I think so, yeah. They have real funny vocalizations.
They get into arguments, and all the arguments end with sex. I've known people like that.
They're not the kind that bite your nose off, at least. I shouldn't joke about that. It's so horrible.
Oh, that was a horrible thing. And living in Connecticut, of course, I heard every little bit of news about that.
That's terrible.
Oh, but
anyway, I do believe people who readers, you know, who like these kind of stories, the adventure stories of the dinosaurs. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in it, just beyond running around from dinosaurs. I think they'll really enjoy this because, as I said, I tried to take this whole lost world theme and give it a modern spin and treat it with a deal of humor and scientific realism as well. And one of the things I do like about it myself, okay, this whole thing, you're supposed to write books that you yourself would read. One of the problems I have with most thrillers nowadays, what's called thrillers, is I just don't like the characters. They're all very white bread. They're all kind of from, central casting. They don't have any real quirks or anything, They have these problems grafted onto them, which come from watching too many after-school specials, there's a lot of, strong, extreme personalities in this book.
Now, having read several of your books, and really looking forward to reading Cryptozoica, and because I've only gotten to read the excerpts that were sent to me, and to Chrissy P, I also have a very strong interest in knowing your insight on some things like lost, I don't want to say human, but it wouldn't be Homo sapien either. Different alien influences and human, different kinds of humans that might be in existence.
Yeah, well, I sort of deal with that. Dealt with a lot of that theme in Outlanders over the years.
Right.
I sort of explain in this Cryptozoica why serpent and dragon iconography were so widespread. At least I theorize or present a theory why it was. And it's stuff that's been, bandied about before over the years, So, but I don't deal with it in a, ridiculous way, Like with reptilians, actually being members of a, royal family or anything like that. I mean, that's cool, but I just can't buy it, that's all.
Now, Amber and I were talking earlier, Amber, about UFOs and sightings of UFOs. Do you personally have any belief in having been visited by aliens?
Me or Amber?
Well, Amber, Amber and I were talking about it, and I just haven't heard from her in a while, and I want to hear her voice. It's so pretty. It's
I kind of like that question, Nathan. Like this whole it's been on the History Channel lately, and the whole Eric Von Daniken ancient aliens race, that aliens influenced our current culture, because of course us as humans couldn't possibly build it. The pyramids or something, so it had to have been an alien race. I mean.
And you, Mark?
Well, I don't necessarily buy into Don Von Daniken's theories, hook, line, and sinker. He comes up with some interesting things and mysteries. But I do think, I dealt with this a lot in Outlanders about the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann as being sort of aliens. They came to Earth, I'm not saying I believe this, but... Yeah. The Anunnaki, people who believed that that was possible from the planet Nibiru, they came to Earth before humans, proto-humans were here on Earth, and they sort of genetically engineered humanity. And quite possibly, since they settled in Mesopotamia, their particular architectural style and various other belief system was disseminated throughout that part of the world, which then, of course, was carried to other parts of the world. So by the time it got to Egypt, at the time of the pyramid builders, I don't really believe there was I don't think there was actually hands-on alien influence. They were just copying what they had already been part of the culture anyway. And that included how to build it. I don't believe that there was aliens using their anti-grav ray or anything to lift the blocks into place.
Well,
Amber. I don't think that either. I think, I was discussing this too recently with a friend that, we kind of feel like humans as a race, we can't imagine building pyramids anymore because we can't imagine being that productive. That we would have that kind of loyalty to a, a king or a queen that we could do something like that for, our king or queen or whatever. But I don't think there was aliens involved in that kind of stuff. I think it was genuine human hard work. And recent evidence suggests that a lot of the pyramid builders were actually very well treated, given food, everything. It was a great job to have back then. And, of course, it took years and years and years and years and lots of blood, sweat, and tears and death to build. But, aliens, I don't think so. I think that's just kind of a far-fetched idea. I think we were perfectly capable of achieving these great feats, and we've forgotten how to achieve such great feats.
Well, sounds reasonable. In Cryptozoic, I postulate that there was a mother culture, but it was not extraterrestrial, that, a lot of these secrets of building sacred geometry, and Nathan knows what I'm talking about here, was passed down, through various secret societies, and not necessarily, Masons or anything like that, but through various other types of secret societies over the years. And we're talking... centuries now. We're not talking. I think one of the problems people have, what Amber was saying, people can't conceive nowadays that humans could build these things. We have no sense of time anymore. 100 years, 100 years seems like yesterday to us or something. Oh, man, you could have, that couldn't have happened, What do you mean it couldn't have happened?
One of my
1,000 years is a long damn time, dude. because they can't wrap their minds around anything. They barely remember what happened the day before.
One of my favorite sayings is the difference between Americans and Europeans is that Americans think 100 years is a long time and Europeans think $100 is a lot of money. It's one of those things where we, in America especially, we just have no concept of time because we have expanded and grown so quickly in such a short amount of time.
Yep.
That we've lost our sense of time. I mean, if you don't believe that we've lost a sense of time, try and wake up on time for work the day after you set your clocks back.
Yep.
It's we have no sense of time in this country.
Well, we have no real clear sense of history either, where at least Europe, in some places, they still have that. So this is one of the things which I suggest in Cryptozoica, that our history as we perceive it is a basic, very shallow, feeble misunderstanding of the tip of the iceberg. I call it the iceberg principle. We're only seeing like what's poking up above the surface, and 80% of it is beneath the surface. You know, and that's our history. You know, the 10% we see that's poking up above the surface, and we don't bother, you know, penetrating below. And it took God knows how many thousands of years for the rest of it, the vast majority of it, to develop. So you have to look at the whole thing. I mean, this is difficult for Americans to do in particular, but I think everybody anymore has a real problem with trying to see the entire... See, you know, you don't even know what the real picture is, but even assuming that there's a bigger picture, even accepting
exactly.
that there's a bigger picture, that's a concept
there was,
that people...
Go ahead, Amber.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Amber.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, like, my concept of time was totally turned upside down. You know, when I've traveled a lot, I've had the luck that I've had family that enjoyed traveling every summer. And, you know, we'd go over to the East Coast where you're at, Nathan, and we go to Boston and New England, and I'm like, oh, my God, this stuff was here in 1700s and the 1600s. This is so old. And then we got the opportunity to go to England and Scotland, and I stood in a place in Scotland called Jedburgh Abbey, or even like Westminster in London. And this thing, you know, well, for example, Jedburgh Abbey in Scotland was celebrating its 1,000th year, you know, and my concept of history was just totally turned upside down about how old things, you know, really, really were, how long we've been here as a race. And, you know, and like Nathan said, we can't even remember yesterday. I mean, we're so obsessed with what's going to happen tomorrow and what's happening right now. And it's just one of the things that just really turned my world upside down, that we really don't have a concept of time anymore, history. It's kind of a fascinating thing to ponder for a while.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a sense of wonder about it, you know. And I was sort of pleased when I read one of the early reviews for Cryptozoica on Amazon, where somebody picked up on that, at least, that I had that imbued the book with the sense of wonder of discovery, the realization that we are not, you know, our presence here is just the latest in a long, long, long line on this planet of life forms and cultures.
Now, do you think it's kind of like we were saying earlier, Amber was bringing up the whole fact that there's nothing to explore anymore. Do you think that comes from the fact that we have given up? Like, we're almost, it doesn't come easy anymore, so we don't want to look harder. And there's only those few people left out there who are actually willing to work at looking for the next big thing that has made people think this?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think another part of it, too, is with everything getting so weirded out since the end of World War II with various countries, it's a lot harder to go tramping around other people's backyards without, you know, 600 different forms to have filled out and inoculations and everything else. I mean, before World War II, if you had the money and the resources and you said, well, I think I'm going to go look for Noah's Ark up there in Mount Ararat, that's fine. You know, you just took the... How, if you got there, you got there, you talk to somebody, you know, in Turkey, and they say, I want to go to Mount Ararat. They say, go ahead, just, you know, you're on your own, dude, you know. But now you have to get the American embassy, you have to do this, you have to do that. You know, God knows what you have to do it. Everything's a lot more difficult.
I don't think you could even, if you went through every channel imaginable, when you sat at the foot of the mountain, they'd come to you and say, you can't go up.
Yeah, they would. I mean, so it's a lot harder than it used to be. I mean, you'd think it'd be easier, but no, it's not. Like we said about, you're talking about, like, with the satellite imagery and mapping, and that's a substitute.
Yeah.
It really isn't. I mean, if that was really the case, I mean, if you were able to pinpoint every place on Earth in a grid, I mean, there'd absolutely be no reason why pirates could operate, terrorists could operate. You know, I mean, these places, you just go there and bomb them, you know?
Right.
But you have to know where you're looking first to be able to feed the coordinates into the computer, to which will then feed it to the satellite, which will then eventually shift wherever it's at, you know, and zoom in on something, you know. So I think people do have the misconception that there's nothing new anymore. There's no new mountains to scale. There's no new hidden valleys or forests or jungles to explore. But that's just not the case.
Well, you know, it's one of the reasons on the Ghostman and Demon Hunter show we set up the rule that no one is ever wrong. We don't tell people they're wrong, even if we disagree with them. We'll tell them we disagree with them, but we'll never tell them they're wrong because we don't want to stifle anybody going out and actually bothering to look.
Right.
So few people are looking. I mean, a couple weeks ago, we had a gentleman on named Aaron Kaplan, and he had written a book, and the book, I believe, was called Deep Analysis. Yes, it was Deep Analysis. And I even said, from a lot of his theories, I said, you know, it sounds like he has read a few James Axler books.
Oh, right. I heard that.
Because he, you know, he was talking about aliens hiding secrets Nazi submarine bases under Antarctica. And to which my account was, Antarctica is a continent. It's not a chunk of ice. I don't understand. But, you know, I'm not going to tell him he's wrong because he's bothering to do research. When how many other people are even bothering?
Well, that's true. I mean, yeah, I've heard there's Nazi bases in Antarctica before, and I guess it's, you know, possible. You know, I supposedly Admiral Byrd, you know, went hunting for them in the end of World War II, I guess, in the early 50s, actually, trying to find that secret entrance into the, you know, Hollow Earth.
Right.
And found Nazis were already there. So they supposedly covered that up real quick.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh.
I can't say I buy that. But, but at any rate, it's I try to, you know, make in Cryptozoic, give send the message in some way or another that it's still possible to find, you know, to discover things out there, you know, as long as you're willing to look.
Well, and that kind of goes with the whole theme of what Ghost Hunter, you know, Ghost Man Demon Hunter is all about. And a lot of these paranormal talk shows is that, you know, a lot of our focus in these shows is talking about the paranormal and the unseen and ghosts and all this stuff. And, you know, and a lot of us get frustrated in this field and go, well, you know, a lot of us turn skeptic and go, well, there's nothing out there, but you know, you got to keep looking. You got to keep searching. And you never know when that little lost piece of the puzzle is going to fit nicely into the big piece. And all of a sudden, you're going to discover something that you completely thought was unimaginable, such as finding a lost fish we thought was extinct or something, you know. I mean, it goes with the theme that just don't stop looking. You know, you always need people out there that are going to constantly believe in something because those are the people that end up discovering something worthwhile.
Oh, exactly. Absolutely.
Well, guys, I hate to say this because it's been a fun, really fast hour and a half. But,
oh, it's been that long. Wow.
We've well, Amber and I have been on for an hour and a half. We've been on for almost 50 minutes now with you, Mark, and we've got to start wrapping up. But I want to throw out again for folks to check out Cryptozoica, Mark Ellis's newest book. You can find it at cryptozoica.com. And in case you're like me and can't spell that, that's CRYPTOZOICA.com. That's CRYPTOZOICA.com. And thanks so much to my guest host tonight, Amber Rose Hammond,
I also want to mention they can find it on Amazon.com, too. They could just type in my name, Mark Ellis, and it'll take them to it.
Okay, and, you know, that would be Mark with a K, MarkEllis.
Right.
And, you know, you'll find it on Amazon. You'll find it at Cryptozoica.com. Find it on MarkEllis.com, too, won't you? It's
Oh, yeah, you can find the, you can find her at markellisinc.com.
Markellisinc.com.
Inc with a K.
And again, thanks to Amber Rose Hammond, my lovely fill-in tonight, who was so kind to join us. Author of Ghosts and Legends of Michigan's West Coast. You can find that on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Borders and all that fun stuff, too. That's Ghosts and Legends of Michigan's West Coast. And, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I was so worried about tonight when we got the call that Sean was going to be here tonight, and to have friends who can come on and help out and to have guests who are just so capable of handling the show by themselves, I didn't need to be here.
I wanted to talk the whole time.
But
yeah, it wouldn't have been the same. No.
But, Mark, thank you so much. And, folks, check out cryptozoica.com. Haven't gotten to read part of it so far. I know I can tell you I will be reading. We've actually ordered our books already. So.
Oh, great. Okay.
So I will be reading it very soon. And a note out there tonight again, folks. Some people asked me last week about that song that I played last week, the Return of Doctor Who, that was by the Basement Slaves. I played it because last night was the season finale of Doctor Who, and all of you know I'm a Doctor Who fan. So
I still need to watch it. I TiVo'd it, but
did you?
I haven't watched it yet.
You know, I'll tell you, it was not the most exciting Doctor Who episode of all time, but I think it was probably one of the most intricate little storytelling Doctor Who's I've ever seen. It had some real intricacies to it that you had to follow and watch from beginning to end. So don't get up to use the bathroom. Pause.
Okay.
On the TiVo. But, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Ellis, Amber Rose Hammond, thank you so much. It's that time of the night when I've got to thank everybody for listening to the Ghostman and Demon Hunter show. And be sure to check us out next week when we'll have another great Ghostman and Demon Hunter show. Next week, of course, will be August. Wow. How can it be August already? We have no sense of time.
Just like we've been talking about.
August 1st. Join us for the next Ghostman and Demon Hunter show. And in the words of the immortal, the fabulous, the beautiful Sean Burris, don't go changing people. We love you. You know we won't. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye.
Guys, can you just hang on until I close out the show?
Sure.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, and talk to you next week.
So say good night to the bad guy.
Well, I don't like much where I work. I'm wasting my precious time. I'm working day in, a slaving day out, and I'm losing my worried mind. I'm running my poor ass ragged, and I'm living from day to day. The boss man telling me what to do just makes me want to say to those heathens and hooligans, you won't get the hell out of here. Bother someone else for a while now, brother, I can use. Yeah.